I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. President Bush is saying the upcoming election in Iraq must be held as scheduled despite rising insecurity in the country, and calls by more than a dozen Iraqi political parties to postpone the voting.
The election should not be postponed. It's time for the Iraqi citizens to go to the polls.
Holding firm to a January 30th Iraqi election is one of the reasons Pentagon officials are citing for their decision made public yesterday to increase troop strength in Iraq to the highest level since the war started last year. In addition to some fresh troops, the Pentagon has decided to extend the deployments of nearly 12,000 soldiers by 2 months, bringing the total troop level to 150,000 and making it the third time the U.S. military has extended deployments beyond the expected one-year tour. Well, joining us on the line is military analyst and Georgetown University professor Dr. Kenneth Allard. Dr. Allard, is this unexpected?
Not really. The handwriting was there on the wall for some time. One of the things that comes out of Fallujah is the fact that more than anything else, that is a very, very well-conducted, very well-dug-in insurgency. And with the prospect of elections, that is very much throwing down the gauntlet to the insurgents. And we have simply got to put military force in there to protect it.
In fact, military spokespersons in Iraq have cited the need to put down the insurgency as another reason for the longer deployment. In your view, should the U.S. military have been able to foresee this?
What I think is really going on here is that you're seeing a greater willingness of the political leaders in and around the Pentagon to accept that what the military advice has been are things they simply have to act on. I don't think there's any question the military saw this coming. But I don't think there's also any question about the fact that we have for a long time needed more troops in the ground on Iraq. And Donald Rumsfeld and the people around him have, been at some pains to say that they had all the troops there that the commanders on the ground required. Now we're going to see just how true that is.
Well, in fact, we should remind ourselves that before the invasion, now retired Army Chief of Staff General Eric Shinseki said many more troops were needed, but Deputy Defense Secretary Paul Wolfowitz disputed that. He said before Congress that he felt certain that Iraqis would welcome American troops with open arms. Any sense of any fallout from that prediction and what's happening now? Any sense of any of these people responsible for the troop strength perhaps being removed from their jobs?
I think that's most unlikely at this moment, simply because of the fact that we've had a referendum on the war. That was the U.S. election here last month. And what has happened is the fact that for good or ill, we are going forward with the team that's now in place.
Well, even a revised war plan called for troop reductions by now. Is there a sense of how many more troops might be needed? Does anyone know?
I don't think anybody really knows because you're having to make it up as you go along. I don't think anybody fully anticipated the extent of the resistance in Fallujah. So anybody that looks at this thing either with a stopwatch or, for that matter, a calendar is simply missing the point. This is a long-term effort. It's going to take many more months.
Well, according to reports, November was one of the two most deadly months for American military personnel. 71 troops trying to retake Fallujah, 623 American troops wounded, higher than previous counts. What do you expect in the future?
I think we are likely to see more of those kinds of headlines. There is simply no way when you're engaged in fighting a very well dug in, very well conducted, very well supplied insurgency to ever be able to predict with any degree of confidence how soon you will be able to win this thing, how soon you'll be able to bring the troops home. And until and unless we have the kind of force in place there that can replace us, the Iraqi military, the Iraqi police force, until those forces are a lot more professional, a lot better trained, the U.S. is going to either be there or simply have to say we were wrong and leave.
What is your sense of time? I mean, we've heard 5 to 10 years.
I don't know 5 to 10 years on anything. But I'm telling you, 3 to 5 is not unreasonable.
Is a guerrilla war winnable?
It is only to the extent, and look, this is so key. Dave Petraeus, the guy over there doing this right now, is a very good friend of mine. He is the best that we have to do what he's doing right now. But that process takes an enormous amount of time. It literally has been compared to, playing the Super Bowl when, you're trying to conduct spring training. That literally is what those guys are facing over there right now. And the decision to have disbanded the Iraqi military when we did just looms as an incredibly stupid mistake.
Retired Army Colonel Dr. Kenneth Allard, military analyst and security studies professor at Georgetown University. Dr. Allard, thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you.
A Blue Ribbon panel convened by Secretary General Kofi Annan presents its findings today, calling for a sweeping overhaul of the UN. We'll have more in a moment. But first, U.S. Senator Norman Coleman has called for Kofi Annan to step down because of charges of corruption in the UN Oil for Food Program, which was created in 1996 to allow Iraq to sell oil to ease the impact of sanctions imposed after the 1990 invasion of Kuwait. Well, the program was to be monitored to ensure that oil was only sold for food and medicine and not weapons, and the Security Council later passed a resolution allowing Iraq to run the program. Evelyn Leopold covers the UN for Reuters News Service. Evelyn, what are the accusations against the UN now?
One is that for all the people who really dislike the UN, it's all Kofi Annan's fault from 1991 to 2003, and he was supposed to monitor. For people who support Kofi Annan, it was the Security Council members, particularly the United States, which turned a big blind eye to oil going into both Jordan and Turkey right from the beginning because these countries were suffering from the embargo.
In fact, Senator Carl Levin, who's with the Investigations Committee, is saying today that the U.S. knew that Saddam Hussein was selling oil to Jordan, to Syria, and by law, the U.S. could have stopped that.
Well, the U.S., we are the only ones who have really the power to monitor properly from the air, from sea, and so forth. But it's very hard to put border guards around Iraq. But we did turn a blind eye to a lot of oil going out. In fact, everything we're talking about was known and was discussed and was printed by oil services like Reuters and Dow Jones have. What is new is this long list of names that have come out of alleged bribes that Saddam paid to governments, political parties, and individuals. And if the names on there are true and they actually received the money, that could be very embarrassing for an awful lot of people.
What are some of the names, and which are the UN officials that are being accused?
Yeah, there's one UN official, and he's head of the program. His name is Benan Savan. That is what will be devastating to the UN if it is proven he actually received the money. And Paul Volcker, the former Federal Reserve chairman, was appointed by the UN to investigate. And the U.S. Attorney's Office is investigating. And those are the two serious non-political investigations.
And then there's also Charles Delfer's Iraq Survey Group report.
Yes, and that's formed the basis for a lot of people's reports. Delfer did a very thorough job saying that he couldn't prove which people took money or not, but these are the 13 lists Iraq had given him of whom they thought took money from Saddam Hussein. And that's where Mr. Savan's name appears. And the Delfer report is the one used by congressional committees, particularly the Coleman-Levin one in the Senate.
Well, as these investigations go on, Evelyn, as you know, there's been a call for Kofi Annan to step down. Norm Coleman, a Republican who actually chairs the Senate Permanent Subcommittee on Investigations, has said that Kofi Annan must go. If he was a CEO of any corporation, he'd be gone a long time ago, not as much because he might have been culpable, but because he was overseeing the UN when these scandalous charges took place.
Yes, I saw that, and most people in the world would disagree with Mr. Coleman and question why Mr. Rumsfeld is still in office. That was sort of the discussion in the hallway at the UN yesterday. To me, it seems rather strange that Mr. Coleman has tripled the number from Charlie Delfer and made Kofi Annan responsible for $21 billion from 1991 till the end of the program.
Here's what he writes. At our hearing on November 15th, we presented evidence that Saddam accumulated more than $21 billion through abuses of the oil for food program and UN sanctions, and he blames that on Kofi Annan.
And Kofi Annan wasn't in office when it all happened, when lots of it happened. This is going on from 91 on. They're throwing every figure in the pot. Nobody else has $21 billion. Again, I go by Charlie Delfer, who understands how this thing works, and he estimates that $2 to $3 billion, which is bad enough, came out of the $64 billion oil for food program.
Well, but doesn't Mr. Coleman make a point that the UN Security Council, some of whose permanent members were awash in Saddam's favors, at least it's alleged, are not likely to be able to investigate themselves, and some have said that there's been stonewalling going on in the investigations, and for that matter alone, he should be removed.
I think that's personally, I think that's garbage. The investigations are they're stonewalling between the UN and Congress because the UN does not want to hand everything over to Congress while Volcker's doing it. Volcker doesn't want interference in there. The numbers are going to be bad enough of what was built from the Oil for Food program, but to throw $21 billion at them, to me, is straight politics.
What about the questions about Kofi Annan's son?
It can be very embarrassing, but it is a total red herring.
Some are questioning how Kojo Annan received money from the Swiss company Cotecna that was hired by the UN to monitor Iraq's imports under Oil for Food. He received payments from them for years after he worked for them.
Right. He never, from what anybody has uncovered, had anything to do with Iraq. He worked in Nigeria and West Africa for them. He received payments. It doesn't look so hot for the Secretary General, but that has nothing to do with Congress and the Oil for Food. That is a real political red herring. I mean, I think it's a great story if we could tie it all together in a nice little knot. And the reporters and columnists that have done so on a really non-objective, non-factual basis. Some embarrassing things have come out, like that he had a non-compete contract for years after he left the firm in February 1998 or 7 or right after the Oil for Food contract.
Which is embarrassing as it is. It's standard with a lot of companies. They pay people not to work for someone else.
Right, and that's embarrassing because Annan didn't know that this. Annan, the father, the Secretary General, says he didn't know this contract went on and he misled people on it. Getting money back for the Iraqi people that was stolen during the Oil for Food program, it's a red herring to look at Kojo.
But Evelyn Leopold, one last question. Isn't there something unseemly about the son of the head of the UN being in any way involved with companies that contract with the UN?
Absolutely. But, I mean, I do believe a bit that the UN bureaucracy is sloppy enough not to have known that at the time.
Senator Coleman also levels the charge that the U.S. would not have had to go to war in Iraq, would not have been forced to put troops in harm's way if the U.N. Security Council under Kofi Annan had done their job in overseeing sanctions and the Oil for Food program and toppled Saddam Hussein in that way.
That's also garbage. First of all, Annan doesn't supervise the U.N. Security Council. We do. I mean, as the strongest nation. I mean, he is absolutely no angel and tried to subvert every bit of sanctions every inch of the way. But everybody had a share in the blame here. You also had people in cahoots with Saddam, and it was hard for the U.S. at different times to move. And at other times, we didn't want to. It affected our oil companies, too.
Evelyn Leopold, U.N. correspondent for Reuters. Evelyn, thank you so much.
You're welcome. Bye.
And when we return, we'll look at the other big UN story, the report being presented today calling for an historic overhaul of the organization, said to make it more effective. Stay with us. Much more ahead, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, continuing our look at the United Nations. Well, today a Blue Ribbon Committee formally presented its report calling for the biggest overhaul of the world body since its creation in 1945. Lee Feinstein is a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. He's also a former State and Defense Department official in the Clinton administration, and he joins us from Washington. Lee, welcome.
Welcome to you.
And before we get to the findings of this committee, let's talk about what Evelyn Leopold, Reuters UN correspondent, and I were just talking about, the Oil for Food program. She says that, as many say, there's substantial evidence of corruption, but the scandal is also being exaggerated, and Kofi Annan's role is being distorted by anti-UN lobbies in this country. Your sense?
Well, look, there are a lot of people in the United States who are trying to take advantage of this politically, particularly those who have been critical of the U.S.-UN relationship. And there's a lot of defensiveness in the U.N. about that. But the truth is, we don't know what the Volcker Report is going to say. This is the report that's coming out in March on the Oil for Food program. And so we really need to withhold judgment. Both sides need to withhold judgment to see what the role has been both of Secretary General and also of the member states of the U.N. in overseeing this program.
Right. Well, let's get to today's. It's called a reform report. Some say it's also an expansion report. It was called for by Kofi Annan because of the war in Iraq. Why?
Well, there was a meltdown in the Security Council over Iraq, and the Security Council and the UN more broadly were losing legitimacy because they were seen as a place that couldn't come to agreement on critical issues to, some of the most powerful member states.
Mm. And it's made 101 recommendations. We're not going to go through all of them, but what are some of the key recommendations?
Well, the key thing it does is it tries to take a snapshot of what the world looks like today after 9/11. And it makes the point that the North and the South have many shared interests, and the threats in the North are threats that can be felt in the South and vice versa. So, for example, failed states can be sanctuaries for terrorism, and so it's in the interests of the North to try to alleviate poverty and deal with states under stress, which is the UN term.
Again, the sense of the North being the wealthier countries and the South being the poorer.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, tell us also how the UN report is dealing with things like insurgencies.
One of the things the report did was it suggested that there be a definition on terrorism, and it came out with some very, very strong language, essentially saying that there's no justification, even for countries under occupation, to deliberately target and kill civilians. And this is something that has been really controversial, and clearly it's a position that will be welcomed in the United States and by supporters of Israel, but I think also of opponents of terrorism more broadly.
Well, tell us, with that in mind, who made up this panel? And is this going to become, you know, a sense that there was some partisan makeup to the panel and that's why there is this outcome?
There isn't partisan makeup, but that's what's so incredible about this group. You have the former foreign minister of Egypt. You've got a former hardline Arabist foreign minister of the Soviet Union on the panel. You really have a very diverse group, and so the fact that they could reach agreement on these issues is interesting. Nobody can say that this was a stacked deck.
Well, you point that out, but you also say that there's a brewing storm on another horizon.
Well, there, in U.S.-UN relations, there's a perfect storm brewing, because of the Oil for Food program. Also, there's a very large peacekeeping bill coming due. And also, Secretary Annan made some statements about the legality of the Iraq war during the presidential election campaign in the United States, and this was received poorly by Republicans in Congress.
Yeah, well, and it's interesting because one wonders, does the U.S. or the current administration even want the U.N. to reform itself, because that might take away some of that conflict?
Well, the way I would put this is it's a very tough time for this report to be coming out, and the question is whether anybody in the United States will really be paying attention in light of the much more sensational scandal that seems to have captured people's attention.
Yeah. What else do you see in the report worth noting?
Well, you know, one of the things that's capturing headlines is the proposal for expanding the Security Council. The report says that no additional states should get the veto beyond the five who already have it, but it offers two alternatives for broadening the representation on the Security Council so that it's better reflective of current population and power realities.
And your thoughts on that?
I think it's a good idea. It's something that the countries that are not represented on the Security Council really want. But, you know, it definitely punts on the key issue, which is how do you square the veto rights with the changes in the world since after World War II when the UN was founded.
Yeah. And what do you think about the future of the UN? As you know, critics say that it's a forum that belongs to another era. It's doomed to irrelevance. Others say that it's the only world body left that can stand up to a superpower, the U.S., and is needed for that balance of power.
You know, the UN is as good as its members. The problem in the UN primarily has been that governments which are not responsible, which are not democratic, which do not treat their own citizens well, have been able to throw sand into the gears of the UN and discredit it. And that's the big problem, how you can disempower those governments which themselves disempower their own people so that they can't block the efforts of democratic governments from pushing ahead the values that we share.
Yeah, well, speaking of that, you know, one of the strongest criticisms is that, for instance, Libya was able to head a UN commission on human rights. It left a lot of people scratching their heads. Is there anything in the new report that calls countries to task for their human rights?
Yeah, I think it was very important that the report talked specifically about the composition of the Human Rights Commission. It said that countries join this commission to prevent themselves from being criticized rather than to advance the cause of human rights. And they pointed out that this is not only damaging to the commission itself, but more broadly to the UN's reputation. Its solution to that was to universalize membership in the Human Rights Commission. I'm not sure that that's the right approach.
Lee Feinstein, Senior Fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. Lee, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, as always, we welcome your thoughts on the UN, on anything on the program. Send us an email at letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org. Or you can call our listener line and leave us a message at 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397. Please tell us how to pronounce your full name and tell us the town you're from. Tomorrow on Here and Now, the showdown in Ukraine. What's at stake beyond Ukraine's borders? That's tomorrow. Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In a move scientists have called very distressing, Congress cut the National Science Foundation's budget on Monday by 2%, the first time that's happened in a decade. The cutback comes 2 years after Congress endorsed a plan to double NSF funding. Lawmakers say fiscal limitations motivated the cutbacks this time, but some critics are skeptical about the administration's support for scientific research. Representative Vernon J. Ellers of Michigan is chair of the Subcommittee on Environment, Technology, and Standards. He voted for the 2005 budget on Monday, but has been highly critical of the NSF budget cut that was in it. Congressman, welcome.
Thank you. It's good to be with you.
Well, first of all, your thoughts about the cuts?
I think it's terrible. Absolutely terrible. And I worked very hard on the doubling bill, which you mentioned, and that we passed a few years ago. I do want to make one thing clear. We should not blame the administration for this, because they, in fact, in their budget request, had a request which is $272 million more than what the Congress granted. And the basic problem is the omnibus bill, which comes at the end. All the pieces have to fit together. And there are not enough defenders of science on the in the Congress to really overpower some of the other interests that had their hands in the trough at that point.
Well, I was going to ask, who do we blame? You say it's Congress then.
It is Congress. It happened in the final process of the Appropriations Committee negotiations. Unfortunately, the National Science Foundation has put in the same appropriations budget as the Veterans Affairs Department. And there are always requests to put more money into veterans. It's also in the same budget as housing and urban development. And as you know, they're short of money to provide public housing. And so the National Science Foundation, NASA, EPA are all put into a competition with two very popular causes. And that's one thing I'm hoping that we can change.
And no one would want to rob Peter to pay Paul. And that is a tough spot to be in. But you've also said that you feel that there are people who don't appreciate science. You know, some people would go further and say there are members of Congress and in the administration who are anti-science.
I would be hard-pressed to find anyone who is anti-science. But the problem is, even though they are pro-science, it may be seventh on their priority list. And when things get that far down the priority list, they don't get the attention and support they need. Mm-hmm. But earlier in the year, when I tried to get an increase in the National Science Foundation budget, I managed to get well over 150 signatures from my colleagues in Congress asking the appropriators to increase the National Science Foundation budget by a substantial amount. I have done that for several years now, and frankly, NSF has really benefited from my efforts for a number of years. But right now, this year, they got socked hard, and it's just one of those unfortunate things that I'll try to correct next year.
Well, and how would you correct it?
Just a lot of persuasion, talking to individuals, getting the leadership to support my efforts. That's the way Congress works. The only power we have is the power to persuade, and so I'll be spending a lot of my time persuading. And I'm sure in your area there, where you have some of the world's best universities and research centers, that a lot of people in your area would support that. And I hope they will make certain that all their representatives and senators are supportive of my efforts.
Well, Congressman, why is this so important to you? I mean, you know, we know that science is important, but it is very important to you. Why?
Well, partially, I know a lot about it because I'm a scientist. I'm the first research physicist ever elected to the Congress, or so I have been told. But also, science is a seed corn, and if we're not funding it, we're eating our own seed corn. And that means in the future, our children and grandchildren will suffer because we haven't been willing to make that investment. The benefits we're enjoying now in terms of our economic boom, the Internet, the dot-com boom, all the other things, as well as MRIs, CAT scanners, all of those are based on research that was done when I was a graduate student in the 60s. And we could see those things coming, but we didn't know precisely what would happen. We were doing very basic research, establishing the fundamentals that now provide all these wonderful things and improved our standard of living and our economy. If we don't continue to fund at the level that our parents and grandparents did, we're simply depriving our kids and grandkids of a major opportunity for a better life.
We already know that scientists in this country are being replaced by scientists from outside of this country, coming to this country.
Well, actually, there's a problem there, too. Because of our tight immigration standards, it's getting much tougher to get scientists to come in from other countries.
To replace the ones who aren't being trained here.
That's right. I spend more of my time on trying to improve math science education in our K-12 systems than I do on funding of science, because that is equally crucial to our future as a nation.
Well, Congressman, with all of this in mind, I want to go back to a comment that you made. You said you'd be hard-pressed to find anyone in Congress or the administration who's anti-science. But I just want to revisit that because there are people who say they feel it. They feel it in the president's lack of support for stem cell research, in a sense that sort of a faith-based interpretation of science, creationism is one example, is creeping into government. You say you don't see that.
That's totally separate. The president's stance on stem cells is not an anti-science stance. It's a moral decision on his part, and frankly is supported by a huge number of people across this country. And the issue of creationism, that's totally separate, and I don't think that's really in the federal domain, and I don't believe I'm not aware of any moves at our level to deal with it, but it certainly is an issue at the local level in many areas of the country. But I don't see anyone who's anti-science. The problem is when it comes to the funding, the money just hasn't been there. We have done extremely well, by the way, under Newt Gingrich's leadership and inspiration in funding the National Institutes of Health. We have put billions of additional money into that. But NASA, the Department of Energy, and particularly NSF are the fundamental research that we need, and that has not been funded adequately.
Yeah. It's funny, too, because you would think in an age of a war on terrorism, which is being fought on, in some ways, highly technical levels, you'd think that there'd be an interest in funding science for that alone.
I certainly agree with you, but part of the problem, you have to recognize most of the people in this country are not well educated in science, and the Congress is representative of the public. Mm. And so most congressmen would say, I really don't know much about science. I support it, but they really are not sure what should be supported. And many turn to me for advice, and I'm happy to give that. But when it comes to funding and the pressures are on there to provide more funding for the veterans or for housing, that's when science tends to suffer.
Congressman Vernon Eller is a Republican representative from Michigan, a scientist, and chair of the Subcommittee on Environment, Technology, and Standards. Congressman, thanks so much.
It's a pleasure being with you, Robin.
Still to come, what to do when you're two novelists who also happen to be diehard Red Sox fans. Well, you write the book on the season that seemed too good to be true. You're listening to Here and Now. For months, New York Yankees star first baseman Jason Giambi has been denying to the public that he used steroids. But according to a report in today's San Francisco Chronicle, he admitted before a grand jury a year ago that he had in fact used steroids and injected himself with human growth hormone. Major League Baseball has been testing its players for steroids sporadically over the past two seasons, but critics say the league has been too lenient compared to other professional sports. Well, joining us now in the studio is Bill Littlefield, host of NPR's weekly sports program, Only a Game. And Bill, I know you're shocked.
Absolutely.
Drugs and sports. But remind us, why were Jason Giambi and more than two dozen elite athletes summoned to testify before a grand jury in the first place?
Well, federal authorities had been investigating and they had been surveilling the Bay Area Laboratory Cooperative for some time. The suspicion was that the people in there had been distributing so-called designer steroids to various elite athletes in various different sports. Baseball wasn't the only one. And eventually there was a raid, and they confiscated various materials, and there were indictments, and there was a grand jury.
Right, and that grand jury indicted Greg Anderson in particular.
Right.
And is he the trainer for Barry Bonds or for many of the famous players that
For many of the famous players, and his name keeps coming up, apparently, in this testimony. And, of course, we haven't seen most of the testimony. The testimony that we have seen, as you mentioned, is leaked, and who knows what turns
right.
up next.
Well, take us through some of this leaked testimony. When did Jason Giambi allegedly start taking steroids? When did he meet Greg Anderson, the weight trainer?
According to what was in the news today, he... Giambi was taking steroids well before he had anything to do with Balco or Anderson, and was taking them in before 2002. Met Anderson in 2002 in Japan on a players' tour, and started asking Anderson, "Say, I understand you work with Mr. Bonds. You're doing a pretty good job with him. How can you fix me up so that I'll be as resilient and in the kind of shape that he's in when I'm his age?" And that began their association.
And we hear about some of these steroids that Jason allegedly, again, was taking. Some of the names we know, the human growth hormones and such, but the clear and the cream, what was that?
Yeah, it goes all the way back to decadurbabolin, which is a well-known steroid, Clomid, which is actually a female fertility drug, which sometimes is used apparently to accelerate the effect of testosterone, which he was also using, human growth hormone. The great advantages of the clear and the cream that you've brought up is that they are allegedly undetectable, although doesn't that seem to be the sort of thing that you would tell a client if you were selling him something illegal? You don't have a thing to worry about. This is undetectable.
Right. Well, and it's interesting that in the leaked testimony, Giambi allegedly said that he didn't notice a huge difference in his performance after using the illegal drugs. But now there were murmurs during spring training of this year that he'd stopped taking the steroids, and that's why he looked so thin. He was benched with mysterious ailments. One was a tumor on the pituitary gland. Now, again, this is all speculation.
Yeah,
but
it is. There are some historical medical connections. Specifically, Clomid has been associated with promoting growth of tumors on the pituitary gland. Women aren't supposed to take it if they have tumors on the pituitary gland. Nobody has said that it causes them, apparently. I don't know. The problem here is that if Jason Giambi is to be believed, he was taking such a great collection of various things that it's going to be a little bit hard for anybody short of, a real scientist to figure out what caused what and when.
Right. Such a cocktail. Well, in the few seconds we have, Bill, How is this reverberating? I mean, baseball's not in season right now. I mean, what, is there a buzz about this? Or?
Well, the strange thing about baseball, Robin, is that Giambi won't be disciplined by baseball because he hasn't tested positive, and that's the only circumstance under which baseball would be likely to discipline him. Baseball, you know, he could say whatever he wants at this point. And it is true that many people feel baseball has been irresponsible, certainly compared to the other major pro sports, in terms of how they deal with these matters.
To be continued. Bill Littlefield, host of NPR's weekly sports program, Only a Game. Bill, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Fans of the Boston Red Sox are known for their devotion to the team, and as we all know, but it's worth repeating, that devotion finally paid off this past baseball season when the Sox reversed the curse, beat the Yankees, and captured their first World Series title since 1918. Well, two diehard Red Sox fans, fellow novelists Stephen King and Stuart Onan, chronicle the storybook season in their new book, Faithful. Stuart Onan told Here and Now's Bob Oakes he and King wanted to share the ups and downs and their second guessing of Red Sox manager Terry Francona as they experienced them. So they wrote the book in real time during, not after, the season.
You want to get it while it's hot. You can't look back. Like if you tried to start writing a book about the season right now, it would be all false because you know what happened. So you want to get it while it's happening so you get all that sort of all the emotion, but also the second guessing. I mean, we're always pounding on Francona throughout the season. And the Nomar trade where we get, you know, we get a first baseman, which we don't need, and we get a shortstop. We already have four of them. And we're like, oh, what a terrible trade. So there's a lot of that in there.
What is great about this book is that as you read it, you can feel how you guys really suffer and then exalt through the ups and downs of this team.
Well, it's a fan's book. It's not a sort of a behind-the-scenes privileged access kind of thing. It's what we as fans always feel. You know, we're always separated from the players. We're not quite sure what the upper management's doing, but we're there. You know, win or lose, we're there.
You have something you want to read for us?
I'll read a little section. This is from July 4th, and we're playing the Braves at that point. We've been struggling. We've just lost a bunch of games to the Yankees. I'm reading on the beach when my nephew Charlie says the Sox are winning 4-1. I wander into the house to see for myself and watch as Derek Lowe gives up a walk, an infield single, another walk, a ground out by pitcher Mike Hampton that scores a run, a single, a double, a single. We've all seen how quickly Lowe can melt down, and throughout this sequence we're begging Francona to lift him. Yet for most of it, there's no one warming up. Francona lets him throw to lefty Chipper Jones, who predictably sticks one in the bleachers. It's 8-4, and everyone around the set is swearing. Francona finally calls on new guy Jimmy Anderson, who walks his first batter on four pitches, then gives up a double to Andrew Jones and a triple to Charles Thomas. I've only been watching for 10 minutes, and Atlanta's sent 10 guys to the plate. Can they fire a manager in the middle of the season? Charlie asks.
It's so strange. This moment is so strange in this respect. You just read a piece from July 4th, and I had the book opened to July 4th.
Oh, my.
Because I wanted to read the email conversation that followed that July 4th game. Stephen King writes, Sox getting roasted 10-4. When I snoozed off, it was 4-1. Good guys. This be bad. Another day, another shellacking by a sub-500 ball club. Another series lost to the same. It's time for Francona to go while there's still a season to save. And you write back, Francona the terrible. You really didn't have faith in him in the midseason, did you?
Well, no. He was managing poorly. As Sox fans, we expect a manager to make the right moves to win the game. And when he'd make a bonehead move like that, I mean, leaving Lowe in to give up, what, 8 runs in one inning? That's obviously the wrong move. So he had a very sharp and steep learning curve throughout the year. Remember, he had Millar and Ortiz out there playing first base when he had David McCarty, who's got a brilliant glove, sitting on the bench.
What was the low point for you, the low point of the season?
Low point of the season was probably when the Yankees swept us down in the stadium, and each game seemed more painful than the last. And one of the games in that sequence was an extra inning game where I think it was the 11th or 12th inning, and Manny hits a shot off the TV platform in left center to give us the lead very late in the game. Laskanik comes on, gets two quick outs, and then suddenly it just all falls apart. And I'm like, how do we let this one get away? I mean, and to lose to the Yankees at that point in the season, we're 10.5 back, we're not playing well. I was like, you know, these guys. But then all you have to do is look at the Yankees, and you get that faith right back. You're like, you know, those damn Yankees.
But at that moment, was there despair in the Steve Onan corner of Red Sox Nation?
There's some despair. You know, anytime that you blow a game like that, you're like, and it eats at you and eats at you. And you can't wait to get to the next game to get back on the winning track.
Other than the playoffs, what was the high point of the season, the regular season?
I got to say, it was that stretch in late August, early September, where we had 9 straight games against our rivals for the wild card, and that's Oakland, Anaheim, and Texas. And I thought in that span, if we went 6-3, we'd make the playoffs. We'd take care of business. We went in there, we went 8-1. And we kicked some butt. We swept the A's. We swept the Angels in a great series. And we beat Texas 2-1 and basically buried their wild card hopes. And we took care of business there. We beat good teams. We played very well.
Was that when you started to believe again? Is that a fair question? Did you ever not believe?
Oh, no. I believe the whole way. I mean, from February on. Hey, look at the team. It's a darn good team. And you had Schilling and Petey right there, a pair of aces. And for the first time in years, we had an actual closer in Folk. And they got it done. We thought if we could just get to the playoffs, all we had to do is get to the playoffs and then let the pitching take care of it in the short series. And that's exactly what happened. There was a little speed bump there with the Yankees there in the ALCS. But, I mean, look at the World Series. I mean, games 2, 3, and 4, Lowe, Schilling, and Petey, 20 innings, 0 earned runs. And they did what they were supposed to do.
You must have had your doubts, though, right to the end. I mean, you know, you are a Red Sox fan.
Well, I mean, players came through this year, stepped up this year in a way that the players hadn't in the past. I mean, David Ortiz is just a massive clutch hitter all year long. He was just a great clutch hitter. Mark Bellhorn delivered all kinds of great clutch hits throughout the year, even though he struck out, you know, nearly 200 times across the season and the postseason. So, no, the way that we handled the Angels, I mean, sweeping the Angels was big. We swept the White Sox in Comiskey in August, something that, you know, we haven't done in maybe ever, I think. So this team played very, very well, and they were a good team. They weren't playing over their heads at all. For part of the season, they played a little under their capability. But they came through. They showed, you know, what they had, and we had a lot.
And did you have a lot of confidence in the playoffs?
Oh, yeah.
When the Sox were down to the Yanks?
Well, that was easy to have confidence because you just hate the Yankees so much. It gives you that extra energy to just say, you know, yeah, we're going to beat them. We're going to beat those jerks.
Anything else to say, was
no,
there?
No, there's nothing else to say. You're down 3-0. You say, you know, all we have to do is win one game, and that's the game that we're playing right now. And that's what they did, and they took care of it. You know, extra innings, back-to-back nights, a game that went to 1:30 in the morning. Great, great theater.
I must say that I very much like the acknowledgments right at the end of the book, and I was wondering if I could ask you to read them.
Oh, certainly. Well, first, it's for our baseball widows, Trudy and Tabby. And then, further down the page, and for Ted, Johnny, Yaz, Lonnie, Rico, Tony C., Boomer, Louie, Spaceman, Pudge, Rooster, Bernie, Jim Ed, Freddie, Eck, Ned Martin, Ken Coleman, Dewey, Hendu, Bruce Hurst, Schirmfeller, John Kiley at the Fenway Park organ, Marty Barrett, the Can, Mo, El Guapo, and yes, for you, Billy Buck, and even you, Rocket, and finally for you, babe, all is forgiven.
Those are funny, they're sweet, and the babe gets mentioned last, and after you read his name, you close the cover on the book and close the cover on the curse.
And there on the back is the big pig pile they're doing, and there's the date, October 27, 2004. And, you know, if you're a Sox fan, you'll never, ever forget it.
Stuart Onan, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Stuart Onan, co-author, along with Stephen King, of Faithful. Two diehard Boston Red Sox fans chronicled the historic 2004 season. He spoke with Here and Now's Bob Oakes. And I'm wondering if People who aren't Red Sox fans are sick of hearing of it. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Our production team includes Lynn Menegon, April Peavy, Kevin Sullivan, and Stefano Katsonis. Our managing editor is Kathleen McKenna. Vince Fairchild is our engineer. He's assisted by Mike Toda. Our web producer is Will Thompson. Our newscast producer, Lindsay Kudel. Our interns are Jennifer Miller and Danielle Dreilinger. The senior producer of Here and Now is Mark Navin. I'm Robin Young. Get into your radio and join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.